McCormick by Mary Jane Sharp for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview was conducted in Mr. McCormick's home on September the 9th at 6 o'clock. Hello, Mr. McCormick. First of all, can you give me some personal background about where you were born?
Okay. Ms. Sharp, I was born in Lincoln County, Kentucky, in the community of Houstonville, which is in the western portion of Lincoln County, and grew up in a rural farm background.
What year was this?
Oh, I'm sorry, in 1932.
Okay. Did you therefore grow up on a farm?
I grew up on a farm. We lived on a banker's farm to begin with. My father was a tenant farmer, and then we moved when I was 4 years of age to my grandfather's farm and lived there until I entered the University of Kentucky in 1950 and stayed in the farming business, raising burley tobacco, beef cattle, sheep, hogs, and some dairy cattle, corn, hay, just general farming on about a 150-acre farm there. And that's the way I got through high school and college, because my father died when I was 11 years old. And so it was to my benefit to have the different forms of livestock as I was growing up, and they made it possible for me to get my education.
So did you graduate from the University of Kentucky?
Graduated from University of Kentucky with a BS degree in agriculture in 1954. And at that time, why it was required that all male students at the University of Kentucky take 2 years of ROTC. And having taken 2 years of ROTC, I decided that the small monetary value that I would receive from taking the last 2 years of ROTC would be to my benefit financially. So at the end of the 1954, when I graduated from college, I was also commissioned a second lieutenant. And then I went into the Army for 2 years, beginning in September of 1954, and completed that in 56. My wife and myself were married in the summer of 1953, and she graduated we both graduated at the same time. She has a degree in home economics from the university.
Mm-hmm. And do you also have a master's degree?
Yes, I went back. I started work then she was working as a home demonstration agent for the University of Kentucky. And when I came back out of the military, why she was working down in Spencer County, Kentucky, down Taylorsville. And I didn't have any employment lined up, so, or any jobs lined up, and so ran into one of my college professors down at the state fair that year, and helping my wife take 4-H projects down to the state fair, a Dr. Jim Kemp, and was talking to him about employment, and come almost winding up with Fisher Packing House, Meat Packing House down at Louisville. But at the same time, well, the county agent of Mr. Nevin Goble there in Taylorsville said, well, why don't you get into extension work and work in that a couple of years, and then you can go from there. So he took me up to the university, and I met Dr. Perry Summers, who was director of personnel for extension at that time, and had an interview one afternoon, and I guess I was looking for a job, but wasn't really pressing for one. Wife had a job, so I guess I didn't need to work, and we had no children at that point, so it wasn't as important to me at that point. And I still had money coming in from being in service as a lieutenant, so I was just kind of coasting along at that point. But had the interview, and make a long story short, why that fall, about a month later, why I moved to Boone County, Kentucky, and started working as assistant county agent working with 4-H boys and girls and working with Joe Claxton, who was the county agent up there, and enjoyed it very much. Lived in Florence, Kentucky, where it was still kind of like a one-horse town at that time, but that was in 1956. Today it's almost a metropolitan one. It became one of the fastest growing towns or cities in the country at one point there. I worked up there for about 2 years, and then the university administration wanted me to go back to school and get my master's. Mm. Well, I received a fellowship, and I had the GI Bill coming to me from being in service previous, and went back in the fall of, 58 and 59. Mm-hmm. Spent two semesters down there. And then in the spring, I believe it was June the 1st or somewhere thereabouts, why I came to Fleming County, where I'm presently located, to be the county agent here. And also at that same time, why I took over a military company in the Army over at Moorhead. So I had my hands full.
Yeah.
And by that time, we had our first two children, Patsy and Joe. And we were a young, striving family trying to get ahead, I guess, at that mm-hmm. particular point.
What rank do you currently hold in the
In 1977, I was promoted to a full colonel in the Army Reserve program now. And I just this summer went to 83 to National Security Course up at Norfolk, Virginia, which I enjoyed very much. Mm-hmm. But come next 3rd of July of next year, 1984, I'll have completed 30 years with Uncle Sam, and that will complete my military career.
Oh. All this time that you were in various counties and moving around when you first came to Fleming County, did you always establish yourself on a farm, or did you live within the city limits?
No, when we
town?
First, yes, thank you. When we first, let's see. I lived on a farm, my wife did too, up until 1954, so to speak, other than like in the summer when we'd go back home. Okay, and then went away to military for 2 years, as I stated. When we first moved to Boone County, we lived in town, more or less, or in a, not in a, on a farm, in other words. Then when we came to Fleming County in 1959, well, we rented it for 2 or 3 months, and then we built a home in Flemingsburg, and we lived there until the spring of 1968. And in 1967, that fall, in October, we bought our present residence, which is Route 1, Flemingsburg, Kentucky, located about a mile and a half out of northwest of Flemingsburg here. And we have been a residence here since then. We moved out here after we did some work on the farm, on the house property here, and we moved into it in the spring of 1968, and this has been our residence until the present, up until now.
Can you give me some information on your farm that you're now living? How big is it? What is your main crop?
Okay, the farm that we have here now, we first bought in 67, bought two places with a total of, bought them from the Mrs. Wilma Dye's estate from her, and there was 156 acres in that. That was in 67. And then in 1975, we bought an adjacent farm here, which there was 170 acres in that, giving us, I believe that's 326 acres. And then last year, my son returned from the Marines, and we bought about 85 and a half acres across the road right over here. It's adjacent to us. Mm-hmm. So we've got a little bit better than 400 acres mm-hmm. in here. The main crop on the farm is burley tobacco, and we raise, last year we had a total of 21 acres altogether, counting the tenants and everyone. This year, we're down to 12 acres. And it's a dry year and not going to be too productive, so this is a short year. We run beef cattle, cows and calf type of operation, and there's about 200 cows that we run. And then sell the calves right straight off of the nursing cow as feeder calves on a local market or however best we can market those. And of course we raise corn and hay, but that is all normally fed back to the cattle. And the two main items we have to sell are burley tobacco and beef cattle or beef calves.
And how much tobacco do you raise on the average? What's your tobacco base?
Yeah, my tobacco base here is around 16,000 pounds. But we generally always buy base until this year, and it was not a profitable situation to buy base. So but it'll change. It'll come back to a certain extent.
Okay, you have five children?
We have four children.
Four children, okay.
Four children,
Can you give me some of the advantages that you think there are to raising children on a farm as opposed to in town or in a city?
There's always constant employment to utilize their excess energy as teenagers on a farm. Sometimes in town, there's not something to keep the children always gainfully employed. And there's always plenty of work to do on a farm, and it's normally there's things they can have a sense of responsibility by raising calves and it's an economical deal with them too, because they can see that for the fruits of their labor, while they can make some money out of it. And we have had in our own family, whether good, bad, or indifferent, why they start managing their own money at age 13 when they become teenagers, for their clothing and for their school lunches and whatever. I feel like that it's better if they start managing at an early age, that they'll be better equipped when they become adults to manage their economic side of their life.
While they were growing up, were they active in 4-H, in the school, or FFA, or any of it?
They have all been in 4-H, and the boy has been in FFA. They normally have shown 4-H calves at a local calf show, is what most of them have, as far as their 4-H project is concerned. Yeah. They haven't been as active in 4-H and the boy in FFA as maybe some children have been, though. We haven't had any state champions or anything like that, and we just use the calves that are here on the farm are only homegrown calves, and those are the ones that they show. Well, ours is only a grade herd, so therefore they won't stack up in a show as well as the purebred calves will, and we don't win the grand champions and that sort of thing, but our feed efficiency of our calves over the years have been in about the top 5 or 6 in the local show. So we're real happy with that portion of it.
Did your children, as they were growing up here, did they have regular chores that they had to do daily? You mentioned responsibility that they would gain from living on a farm.
If they had a calf to raise, yes, it was their responsibility to feed and water and bed and take care of that calf. At one time, the oldest girl was responsible for taking care of the sows and their litters and watering and feeding those. If they have tobacco, well, they have responsibility for helping set that out, and help strip the tobacco crop out and get it ready for market. Or yes, ma'am, they have responsibilities all the time. Now you're thinking of a day-to-day chore like getting in the stove wood in the wintertime. Yeah, they do that too, but that's of a smaller nature than some of the other things are.
Yeah. What about your wife? Let's talk about her for a moment, if we may. is she active in the farm chores or the responsibility of the farm?
Well, my wife, yes. She, after we started raising a family, well, she got out of employment with the University of Kentucky as a home agent, and that would be back in, about 1957, I guess it would, and then she started back into employment here locally in Fleming County teaching school. She went back and got a temporary teacher certificate. She taught school for 9 years, and she got out of that last year because her certificate was up. She owns half the farming operation here, and she drives a tractor for us, or what we've kind of got a theory that women shouldn't lift a whole lot, but that certainly setting tobacco and stripping tobacco and driving a tractor or mowing hay or raking hay, why, they help with those type of things on the farm. Yes, we couldn't farm here if it wasn't for the women's side of it helping us.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Do you hire any full-time people to help you on the farm?
I used to before the son returned, but after he has returned to home, why, we don't need them. We round bale, the big, large round bales of hay, and feed it back out, so that can be done from a tractor seat, so to speak, anymore, and it's not the manual labor that's required that used to be of putting up hay. The main time that I have to hire labor is setting tobacco, particularly housing tobacco, and then some labor in stripping tobacco. But hay and corn and fooling with the cattle, working those, why, we don't hire any help. And we've almost eliminated, other than a little help at stripping, at setting the tobacco crop out, pulling some tobacco plants, and the three children and my wife ride the setter, and I drive it, and then we hire some people to help pull plants. But now when we house tobacco, cut and haul the tobacco into the barn, we have to hire help to do that. And normally there are people from, well, Lewis and around and adjacent areas here that are looking for extra work, and haven't been too much of a problem for us to get labor.
Yeah. Okay. Let me ask you a few things about farming in general, if I may, for a moment here. First of all, I think last year, I'm sure you probably recall, it was very big on the television and in the newspapers about farmers who were marched on Washington and some who had been foreclosed on and this sort of thing. In your opinion, do you think the farmer generally has been treated unfairly?
By who?
Well, by government or by, in terms of having, you know, the federal loans and all these sorts of things. It seemed to me last year they were kind of asking about having lower interest rates on the farms. Should farmers have special treatment and that sort of thing, do you think?
Well, I guess it depends on which way you look at your question there. My own personal opinion, if the farming business could be economically in business as other businesses in our society are, I would be in favor of the government programs being deleted from the farmer. Now, what are you saying, Glenn, pertaining to this? Well, you must realize that a farmer buys retail and sells wholesale. And this puts him at a big economic disadvantage. So what I'm saying is, if he could, and none of our other businesses that I know of offhand operate in this same sort of thing, you go in and buy a loaf of bread in the store, or you buy a new automobile, why, they've got a price on that commodity. Nothing that the farmer sells does he place a price on his commodity. First of all, if he did, he maybe couldn't even sell it. Okay, whether we realize it or not, and I realize people that might be listening to this tape think that their grocery bill is high enough today, but still, it's not the farmer, the producer, the basic producer, that's receiving the high rate that is costing all of us, because we have to buy groceries back too. And I'm not blaming anyone. It's just the way that our society has, we want things pre-packaged. We want it pre-cut. We want it practically pre-digested, so to speak, for us. And we're all of us are guilty of that sort of thing because we want it ready to eat. And I think one of the reasons is because we have such a fast-moving society anymore is one of the reasons that we want this. Perhaps one of the reasons is because of that both parents anymore, so many of them in the household are both working, so they don't have the time to prepare the food, the housewife, that she used to have. Mm-hmm. Now, getting back to the answer or pertaining to the government programs, I think that the subsidizing American agriculture, as long as we want cheaper food for the American people, why, it will perhaps be necessary that the government stay in. But over a gradual process, personally, I would like to see the government programs removed. But that's just my own personal opinion. I think it would be a healthier situation for our economics and the country as a whole. Now, what it will do, though, in my opinion, it would place a real hardship on some of the smaller marginal farmers that are barely able to stay into farming economically as it is. Now, and I wouldn't want that to happen to anyone. But I compare it kindly with the little crossroads country store, like you used to see so many of them. Mm-hmm. And now we have the large chain stores that have pretty well driven or taken the place, as you may say it, of the little country stores. It's just no longer feasible or economically feasible for them to stay in business. Way down the road, I see this. I see two types of farms, which we were discussing earlier, in the future in American agriculture. One of them as a small hobby type of farm where basically the living or the family income will be made off of the farm in some other job, working in a factory or whatever job it might be. And they will live in a rural setting. They will have a few acres, may have raise a garden and have a cow or a beef or something of this nature, and enjoy the countryside and the aesthetic value that curtails. Then I see the larger commercial farming operation, which will still be primarily family-orientated. At one time, I thought the large corporation farming operations might come into being, and there will be some of those, but I don't see those as a real threat, so to speak, to a large family operation because of the efficiency of those type of operations. A lot of those are just not as efficient. If it's a family orientated, then they're going to really get out and, I call it hustle, to really work and be efficient to make the business thrive and grow.
Mm-hmm. If someone came to you today, and they very well might, because I think you're depicted as a very successful man throughout the community. So if someone came to you and asked your advice on becoming a full-time farmer, what would you say to them?
If they have the capital and the knowledge of farming to go into it, it's a wonderful business. But it's like any other business. I studied economics when I was in graduate school at the University of Kentucky, and 90% of the businesses that go out within the first 3 years, we were told at that time, and it's primarily because of not enough capital to get going. This day and time, this is one of the most, it's as difficult as any business I would think of to get into because of the low income and the vast amount of capital it takes to get into a farming operation that is economically large enough to be feasible to make a living and to make a profit. Mm-hmm. It's easily to have $500,000 involved in a farming operation and still just be making a decent living anymore. Well, anybody that's got it, you say, well, somebody's got $500,000, won't they just put that on money markets or invest it somewhere and live off? Well, a lot of us, we have to borrow that money to, you know, mm-hmm. I said it takes that much money to go mm-hmm. And to make an economical, feasible package or business, I should say. And it is difficult, and it's seemingly getting more difficult for a young man to get in the farming business unless he inherits it or finds him some young girl that he can marry. Mm-hmm. And that's seemingly the two easiest ways. But if he's just going out here with nothing and starting off from scratch, as farmers say, and trying to make it into the farming business, he's got to really be a good manager, and he's got to work real hard mm-hmm. in order to make it. There's still room for those kind of people, but it used to be that 100 to 125 to 150 acre farm was a large enough operation with a dairy on it to make a nice farming package, and he could make profit. I'm not so sure that I think we're at the point right now. Now you say, well, why are you saying these smaller farming operations are not feasible anymore? Well, farmers used to have plenty of labor. And even though I said earlier to you that it wasn't any problem for me to get labor to house tobacco and this sort of thing, and I think that's perhaps right now as just because our unemployment is high. Normally, that's not necessarily the case. We have replaced labor on farms with machinery. Mm-hmm. And when you buy expensive machinery, in order for it to be economically feasible for you, well, then you must have a large enough operation to justify that machinery. Realizing that the machinery makes it easy to get the job done on the farm, as far as manual labor is concerned, but if you're not baling enough hay, big round bales of hay with a hay baler, and it's sitting idle too much of the time, well, then it's not a good buy for you to purchase that new piece of equipment. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that I'm basing that it must be large enough acreage or operation. Acreage doesn't necessarily mean that it's a large operation, but it must be a large enough operation to justify the cost of the machinery. And too many of us have too much machinery in certain cases to be economically feasible for us anyway. Yeah. We're over machinerized. We buy too much paint, as we call it. That's new equipment when we say that.
Okay. You said you had a son. You mentioned you had a son who has now come back to help you on the farm. Would you like to see your children continue in farming?
No, let me answer you this way. I have advised all four of our children to do in life what they think that they will be happy doing, if they're that fortunate. If he wants to farm and that's his decision, and that's what he's doing at the present time anyway, well then that's fine. And we're here to try to help them. We have, our oldest daughter is married to a pilot in the Air Force. Our middle daughter is at the university and she's studying to be a lawyer. The son is involved in farming here and owns a farm across the road from me. The youngest girl thinks she wants to be a veterinarian. I don't think she's fully made up her mind. I think if it was something to do with horses, she's crazy mm-hmm. about horses. And she has taken her horse to the state fair the last couple of years with a 4-H project group, and they have stayed out at the fair for 4 or 5 days and I think had a ball or had a big mm-hmm. time. And she loves the horses, so I think if she can wind up doing something with horses, she'll be real happy in life. So I guess I'm trying to say if they're fortunate enough that they can do something that they will be happy to do in life. Now, I could go into my fist sermon with you. That's a fist like you double up your fingers and your thumb and talk about the five appendix that we raise our children on. And one of them is your health or your physical aspect of your life. And I know you didn't come to interview me about
this.
No,
this is fine. This is part of what I'd love to have. This is fine.
And another one is your mental or your education. going to school and getting an education. Another one is to be able to get along in society, and that's your social aspect of your life. Another one is your moral aspect and your religious aspect of your life. Now, those are brought up in a lot of different ways, but I add a fifth one, which add the thumb to those other four appendix there of your hand, and that's the economical side. Most of these things have to, somewhere along the line, we have to have some economics to make everything function.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have a theory in talking with the children that it's very important that we don't get, we hold all of our appendix equal and not let one of them dwarf the other. So many times we'll see people that want to take one of those areas of the five, like maybe money, and make that the most important thing. Well, to me, it's not more important than keeping good health.
Mm-hmm.
But then we see people that maybe go overboard in sports or health and leave out maybe some other aspect.
Colonel Glenn McCormick. You're speaking of the five.
And the other was, then we see other people that go overboard with the academic side and keep their head in a book all the time. Well, none of these areas are bad, but then they dwarf some of their other areas of their life that I mentioned there on the, in the tape. So we just think that the child or the human being needs to develop in those five areas, and if raising them on a farm and developing those five areas, and if they can be in a vocation in life that they'll be happy, whatever, why, that this is, well, they'll be successful in life. And if farming is one of them, or married to a pilot in the Air Force is one, or being a lawyer, or fooling with horses, training or raising horses is what the other one wants to do, why, it's their life.
Mm-hmm.
And parents can do an awful lot in guiding their siblings and what they should do in life, but as far as getting around and just absolutely dictating or telling then what they should do in life, we don't think that should be done.
Well, that's good. Okay, let me take you back over the years, if I may, for a little bit here. What are some of the bigger changes or the biggest change that you have seen in farming over the years?
Well, I'd have to say that mechanization coming into farming has caused the efficiency of the American farmer to produce for himself, and the last figure I had on it was 103 or 4 people. He feeds himself and 103 or 4 other people, and they talk about the efficiency of the American farmer. Well, that's correct, but at the same time, it's the people that have invented the machinery or better varieties of crops for us in the research and laboratories in our experiment station. Several years ago, we did not use very many chemicals on the farm in our production. Today, we could not farm without them.
Herbicides,
insecticides, and fungicides, mm-hmm. I'm speaking of.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not one of these that advocate that to use more than we should. I think we should use those to a limited scale, just in a controlled nature, just in order to, for instance, get the insects killed or the disease stopped, rather than putting on too much, because we turn around and I think there can be aftermath effects of some of these that we don't even know. Now, most of the chemicals that we use on a farm before that they're released to for us to use have been tried and tested. Our government requires that the chemical companies do this,
mm-hmm.
you know, before they're put out on the market. So they're normally pretty safe, and it's important that we follow the labels that are on the packages, of course, that the manufacturers are responsible that they're printed on there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to get in trouble real quick, particularly as a county agent, just make sure that, or to stay out of trouble, make sure that the farmers read those labels, because that's very important.
Are there any factors from the past that
that aren't here now that you miss?
Are there any factors from the past that you miss that are not here now? Well, I think we all live in a faster pace, and that's brought on by faster communication, both in travel and our electronics communications and all. Sometimes the slower way of life that we used to live had its values. But on the other hand, I wouldn't want to go back and carry water from a spring up a hill. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't want to have to burn firewood and carry in the coal and everything like we used to do. Nor I'd sure hate to do without electricity if we go back that far. Uh-huh. Now, you're not old enough to know what that era was like. But at the same time, no, I don't want to go back to the good old days, as they say. And I'm an optimist. I look for the future that it will be better. And I think it is. I think we eat better. We're healthier, and we have a better way of life than what we used to have, in my opinion. There's not too many families, and I realize there's some, but in this country there's not too many families that go to bed hungry, particularly if they want to. Now, in inner cities, in large urban areas, I realize there are people that don't have, in other words, they're trapped, and how they get out of that situation, I don't have the answer. I'm not smart enough, and I'm not a politician, so I don't have the answer to all those problems.
Well, looking back over the years, with tobacco and with beef prices, what's the lowest you can remember tobacco selling for?
Well, I only started raising tobacco in the middle 40s, and the lowest I can remember selling tobacco for was around 50 cents a pound. But now, it sold a lot lower than that. It sold as low as 2 and 3 cents back during the Depression, a pound. Now it's up, gotten up as high as, better than $1.90 in certain cases last year. Mm-hmm. So now beef cattle, the lowest that I've ever sold beef cattle was around 20, 22 cents. Sold hogs for 15 cents a pound. There's been a lot of times it's been a lot lower than that, but it was before my time.
Yeah.
And I didn't go through that period. I was born in 32, and there was depression during those years, and I'm sure my parents and grandparents sold hogs and cattle and tobacco at some of those real low figures.
What's it currently at, the beef prices?
Well, right now we're at a down period, and they're low. If you'd asked that a year ago, it'd have been a lot different. Beef cattle prices a year ago were in the, I'd say 60s. Now they're down in the 40s. Mm-hmm. So, and it's because of the real dry weather that we're having during the summer of 1983.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of cattle that is going to market. So your supply is exceeding the demand, supply and demand curve.
Yeah.
And but it'll get straightened out in time. It'll average back out.
Yeah. Okay, we've talked about the past and we've talked about your present lifestyle and your family. What would you mind giving me your opinion on what you think the future of tobacco is in Kentucky?
I have a brother-in-law that owns an interest in 3 tobacco warehouses in Danville, Kentucky, Mr. Tommy Rankin. And he was visiting here on our farm this summer at a family dinner, and both of us were of the opinion in talking to one another that the heyday or the peak of the burley tobacco in the state of Kentucky has already been reached, and that burley tobacco will be around for a long time because of the tax revenue that the different levels of governments receive from it.
Mm-hmm.
The last figures I had, and this is about 4 years ago, while the tax out of $1 that the consumer spends for tobacco products, that's 35 cents of that went for taxes, 36 cents of it went for the manufacturers, wholesalers and retailers got 20.4, and the producer got 8.6 cents out of a dollar. So from a lot of people go to Washington and to different government levels that are elected, and they think that, we're going to do away with the tobacco or tobacco programs. And as soon as they find out right quick how much revenue comes into the treasury from the tobacco product, well, then they start backing up and they realize that, hey, what would we make up this revenue? Tobacco revenue during colonial days of Jamestown was the only product that we had that we could produce cash from, and we sold it back to England, and that kept this country going at the very early history or the development of this nation. I won't get into the pros and cons of whether tobacco is good for your health or not. I'll leave that up to the scientists and the health people to do that. But certainly if tobacco is done away with in the state of Kentucky, they would have to be a big economic drain on this state for a shortfall anyway until some other crop could pick up the slack. And I'm not advocating that hemp would be the crop that would pick up the slack. However, 100 years ago, it was a main cash crop in the state of Kentucky. Hemp was, but it was primarily used for rope then rather than making wacky tobacco, as some of the people call it. Or marijuana is a correct term for it, of course. So tobacco, I think, will be around for some time yet. I think we'll see changes in it. But I don't see that there'll be a real large increase in the economics from tobacco over what it was perhaps in 1982. This year, because of the drought and the cutback in supply and demand. Not supply and demand, but the cutback in the program because of the extra tobacco that we had in storage and all. Why, this will cause the tobacco to, we got a 5% cut last year, and then everybody overproduced and made excess tobacco. So we had to take about, we had a 10, we've probably taken a 20% going into this year cut in the amount that Kentucky farmers would produce. And then with the drought, I don't believe here on my own farm that I will have a third of the tobacco that I sold last year in comparison to what I'll have this year. So I don't know where it will go from there.
Well, do you have any views or opinions about the politicians in Washington? Do you feel, I don't mean this personally really, but how are the politicians viewed by the farmers overall? Do the farmers think the politicians are trying to do a number on them, so to speak, or, and I'm talking primarily about burley farmers, tobacco farmers.
No, I feel like that the politicians are trying to save burley tobacco, the ones that we have from Kentucky that are up there, because in order to save burley tobacco, they're saving their positions also. And that if they can see the handwriting on the wall, if they don't save, try to help save burley tobacco, or at least give it real good lip service. I'm not so sure that they would be able to stay in Washington. I went up there, my wife and myself went up there on a Farm Bureau congressional tour back in February, and we visited with their congressmen and senators and met with them, and also met with people from USDA and had a very excellent 2 or 3 day tour up there. Enjoyed it very much, and was in very, they informed us on what was taking place as much as they could. Of course, to inform you on what's taking place in American agriculture or even Kentucky agriculture would take a lot longer than 2 or 3 days for sure. But I feel like that the politicians are trying to do a good job for the Kentucky agriculture. There's always room for improvement. There's improvement in most of our, improvement in my farming operation, for sure. And they could always do better. I don't mean to say that they couldn't do any better, because they can. And that's something that they can work on, I mean, from that standpoint.
Okay, another thing concerning the future of the farmer, I don't know if it's been felt as much in Fleming County as it has other counties in Kentucky, but it is evident, and that's the process of urbanization, taking over a lot of, well, I guess what you would call prime farmland. what, do you have any opinion about the urbanization that's kind of swept over Kentucky and America, replacing a lot of your farm areas?
Well, it, I hate to see real good farms, pardon the term, but gobbled up by urbanization that are real productive, that we mm-hmm. need in this country, in my opinion, to produce food uh-huh. and fiber for our society and for other parts of the world, too. But at the same time, the economics of growth, people have to have places to live. I guess I'm not real sold on planning and zoning, but at the same time, we need a certain portion of it. I think one of the biggest problems that we have with the American farmer, he kind of wants to have his cake and eat it too. And what do I mean by that? He wants to be independent. But it's difficult to live in society and be independent. In other words, mm-hmm. if you live with other people, you cannot have your own ways 100%. So there's where your planning and zoning comes into being. I don't particularly want someone from town or government coming out here and telling me every move that I make in operating my farming business here. But I'm also realistic enough to know pardon me, that certain aspects overall, it's important that we are governed and controlled in order for my farming operation to exist in a society. For instance, I'll give you a good example. If I go out here and put up, and I'm only about a mile and a half from town on the northwest side, the prevailing winds blow from my farm towards Flemingsburg. If I put up a real stinky hog operation out here, and the odor from that blows into Flemingsburg, and it would, then, heaven forbid, I'm going to get criticized for that. And first thing you know, the county health people or state health people are going to start coming up with reasons that I shouldn't have that hog operation. So this has put a lot, we have thought about putting in a large hog operation out here at one time. And we backed off from it, from the odor from it, because of our location with where we are from town. Oh. Maybe someday we subdivide this and make it into a subdivision. I don't know what it'll be down uh-huh. the road. But for the meanwhile, we're not selling any lots off, or
yeah.
we're keeping it all together as a total farming program.
Yeah. I think that, would you say that there are, compared 1983 to 1973 or 63, there are fewer farmers today than there have been in the past?
I haven't studied the statistics since I've been out of the county agents, and I've been out of county agents since the fall of 74. But we're down to, what, I believe less than 3% of our population are in the farming business today.
That sounds familiar to me, too. 3%.
Somebody would have to check on the statistic books on that. Uh-huh. But it's growing less all the time.
Is it alarming to you?
Well, I'm not really, no, because in a way, it's alarming that those folks are their next generation, their children will have to find employment someplace else, when some of them perhaps would like to remain on the farm, but because of the economics of it, they can't. Today, or the last time I knew, 10% of our larger farmers were producing 90% of our goods anyway. So what I'm saying, you could still take out 9 out of every 10 farmers and you'd only cut production 10%.
Mm-hmm.
That may not be hold true now, but it did a few years back.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so it's going to be a long time, but we can take out still a whole lot more farmers, or farmers can get into other vocations and get out of the farming business, and still we're not going to cut production in this country. And perhaps those that did stay in would become more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And would pick up that extra 10% of the production.
Yeah.
I think it's important that the American farmer produce the food and the fiber and the raw goods that our society, and certainly to help societies around the world, and hope that we can live in harmony. Even though I have been related and associated with military for the last 30 years or better, I'd be the first to say that I hope we don't have any wars.
and that, people can get along on this earth without fighting. But I think the last time when I was in Norfolk this summer, why, there was 15 conflicts going on at the world at that time, around the earth at that time. Somewhere somebody was fighting in 15 different areas at that time. And I guess we'll always, humans will always fight.
Yeah, let me ask you a little bit about your work as a county agent. Can you give me some of the, I know it's very advantageous to have extension offices, especially in the rural areas. What is the relationship between the extension office and the farmer? How do they help the farmer or the farmer's wife?
I don't think agriculture, particularly in Fleming County and a lot of the other counties too, would be what it is today if it hadn't been for the, and not just the county agents and home demonstration agents, but for the soil conservations and ASC and Farm and Home and all the people in this county seemingly pull together and this made it more productive for the farmers of this county. It made it possible for them to have a more productive business. And this county is real large in dairy, and I think it's right now ranks third in the state of Kentucky in the number of dairy cattle and the size of production that takes place in Fleming County. And that has allowed a lot of your 125 to 150 acre size farming operations in acreage to milk 30 to 40 cows and have an economical package on their farm that they can make a living and support a family. And in most cases, provide a college education for their children, too. And to me, that's good that they can do it, because in the beef cattle or tobacco, because of our acreage control or poundage, the amount that we're controlled on the tobacco, and only allowed to grow so much, you couldn't do it. In other words, it's just not enough. You can't generate enough income. However, the dairy farmer is facing some dilemmas and problems too right now, because the price of milk is going way down and his production cost, his feed cost, is going way up for the short run anyway.
Yeah. Well, one of the last questions I'll ask you, and you might want to take a few moments to think about it. What would you say is your philosophy in life?
What is my philosophy in life? I don't really know how to answer that. I guess if I had my ultimate wish in life, and I've related to this earlier, and that there was a magic ball that you had there, Mary Jane, in front of you, and I could look into it and say, well, what would you like to have if you could only be granted one wish? What would you like to have? And I guess I would have to say happiness, because I would place other things in life within that realm or come under that total umbrella. Money is important, security, from sense that it gives you security. But the happiness of seeing your family grow up and be well adjusted, for quotes, whatever that means, having the children to be healthy and happy, and socializing with other people in the community, this is important to us. Our church and the work in it is important to us. Enjoying good health. I guess I get back to my four little fingers and thumbs again. It's kind of like my philosophy of life. And if a person keeps those five things in balance, why, in most cases, why, they should have a pretty decent life. They may not be rich. They may not be the best athlete in the country. And they may not be the smartest academic person in the country. But they should be well adjusted and be able to exist in our society without.
Would you say then, Colonel McCormick, that you're a happy man with your life at this point?
Yes, I feel like I'm a happy man at this point. There has been times in my life that have been ups and downs. I haven't been able to achieve some of the goals in life that I would have liked to have achieved. But those are sour grapes, days gone by, and things that, and all of us have different goals. If I had life to live over with, I would be more successful perhaps than I am, but I think that's the case with a lot of people. I'm not willing to apply myself at this point in the game, at my age at 52, at the expense of gaining economically to lose out on the health end of it. So I guess I'll have to be content in my later years of life with just achieving so much in life from a monetary standpoint. So yes, I'm quite happy.
You have no big regrets then?
No. Life's been very good to me.
Okay.
Life has been very good to me.
And for what it's worth, I consider you a very successful man for what you've accomplished over the years. And I especially thank you for this interview. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sharp. I appreciate it.